Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Greetings, genies everywhere, and welcome to another round of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Great comments have come in over the past week concerning last week's show about my mother deliberately stowing away on a ship to Hawaii in 1947 with three friends. Alan in Baltimore emailed, "Fisher, your mother's friend Terry, even at 90, sounds like she could stow away on a ship right now. She was a hoot. Thanks for sharing her and your mother's crazy story with us." Brenda in Chattanooga commented, "I love Extreme Genes. Out of all the things I've learned, and there's been a lot of them, I take comfort in knowing my family isn't the only one with people doing crazy stuff. Fisher, sounds like your mom got away with one on that ship." Well, I'm not so sure about that, Brenda. She lost a great job and a lot of potential that came with it, but she had a story that mesmerized people for decades. And I think I now know where the genetics came in that led me to sneak into the Yankees dugout and clubhouse to meet the players when I was a teenager. You need to see my autograph collection. It was big. Hey, don't forget to check out all the vintage pictures and articles relating to the stowaway story on extremegenes.com. Hey, just a reminder, we've got a growing community of passionate family history sleuths on our Extreme Genes Facebook page. So check it out and give us a like and tell your friends about it. Our guest this week is someone you may already know. Kenyatta Berry is one of the hosts of PBS's great program, Genealogy Roadshow. She is a family history lecturer, professional researcher specializing in African-American heritage. She's an attorney. She's one of those people that has somehow been granted 36 hours a day. Kenyatta is going to share with us how she got on Genealogy Roadshow, her best experience there so far, her take on the return of Roots to television in 2016, as well as at least one major myth about researching Black history. You may be as surprised as I am. She'll be here in about 8 minutes. Then Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, returns from TMCPlace.com to talk about when you should be concerned about your old negatives turning to dust. Yes, it may frighten you to hear what he has to say. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. This has got to be the biggest story this week. It's from St. Louis Magazine. Imagine how you would feel if you learned that a man was conducting tours of graveyards and sites relating to your family and their legacy and claims his father is a previously unknown son of your mother. Well, we're talking about the Lemp family of St. Louis. At one time, the William J. Lemp Brewing Company dominated the St. Louis beer market. This was pre-Prohibition, of course. When Prohibition hit, the Lemps lost their Falstaff trademark, and the brewery was shut down. Well, over the next several decades, three family members committed suicide in the Lemp family mansion. Well, as a result of all this, few descendants today ever speak of their heritage, and one woman has even instructed her children never even to use the Lemp name. Well, then in 2010, a man emerged claiming to be the last of the Lemps. He called himself Andrew Lemp Paulson, saying he was the last descendant of the eldest daughter. He would travel from northern Illinois to St. Louis to share Lemp memorabilia with interested parties, with an eye to creating a Lemp museum one day. He even set up a website called Lemp Treasures to sell memorabilia purported to have belonged to his illustrious ancestors. He had a key to the Lemp Mausoleum and paintings done by one Louise Lemp. He used Facebook to share incredible stories of his ancestors with the public and the press. He spoke of his grandmother, Anne Marie Conta, who he said had taught him many things and had charged him with the responsibility of preserving the legacy of the Lemps. Well, with all the attention, the Lemp Mansion was named to the list of top 10 most haunted places in America. Now, the problem with all this is that his alleged grandmother, Anne Marie Conta, died in 1973. 11 years before Andrew Paulson was born. Anne was indeed a daughter of Annie Lemp of St. Louis, but grew up in New York, where she had two daughters through three marriages, neither of which had children of their own. 2 years ago, the eldest daughter ran across one of Paulson's eBay listings concerning the Lemps.
she asked a cousin to look into it. The cousin, Jeffrey Legler, did. He found dozens of photos of a woman that certainly wasn't Anne-Marie Konta, as well as a photo of his own great-grandmother, Mariah Amanda Goodhue, to whom Paulson attributed a wild story about a limp staffer being killed at a party by a chandelier and her concern that canceling the party would mean the caviar would go bad. Well, Legler's eyes about popped out. Emails began to fly. Lawyers became involved. But Andrew Paulson has never produced a single document proving his link to the family. He has changed birth dates to align them properly in the family timeline and made excuses that his aged father would have his health impacted if he were to trouble him to produce a birth record. Oh, and that mausoleum key? It was given to him by the current owners of the Lemp Mansion after convincing them he was a descendant. Needless to say, the two daughters of Anne-Marie Konta are beside themselves that this Andrew Paulson is saying Anne-Marie gave birth to his father out of wedlock. Interestingly, the dates of his father's birth, which Andrew has changed at least twice, always line up with something else that was going on in Anne-Marie's life, such as the fact that she was pregnant with her daughters at the time Jensen claimed his father was on the way. Needless to say, it's a complex and fascinating story that leaves everyone baffled why someone would want to hijack another's family history. There's a lot more to this. Read all about it at ExtremeGenes.com. And that's your Family Histoire news for this week. And coming up next, I'll be talking with one of the stars of PBS's Genealogy Roadshow, Kenyatta Berry. She'll fill us in on some of the misunderstandings and complexities of researching African-American history on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with my friend Kenyatta Berry. She is, of course, one of the hosts you all know from Genealogy Roadshow. First time on the show, Kenyatta, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
No, we're excited to have you. And last week we were talking about how Roots looks like it's going to be coming back sometime in 2016. Now, that was the mini-series with LeVar Burton back in 1977 that still ranks as one of the most watched mini-series in the history of television. So I'm thinking, you know, this is kind of a sacred thing for a lot of people to think that somebody could actually remake it and make it even better than it was originally. What are your feelings about this?
Well, I think it's great to have Roots come back because it'll show for the younger generation kind of understanding about slavery. And I think we see a lot of TV shows and movies that are related to slavery, so it's sort of a hot topic. It will be interesting to see how they treat the story compared to when they did originally. And as everyone in genealogy knows, Roots kind of changed or shaped genealogy and family history because people became so interested in discovering their ancestors after watching that miniseries.
Yeah, I remember when that thing came out at the time, and it was just absolutely, it was one of those shows that you didn't see on the networks, but you saw it elsewhere, and yet everybody was still as intrigued by it as anything they would have seen on CBS or NBC or ABC at that time. And now to see it come back, it will be interesting. What a challenge, though, to try to redo something as iconic as that for LeVar Burton.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it will be interesting to see what they do with it and how much it changes. I mean, I remember watching it and seeing it, and it was very kind of raw and just real for a lot of parts that may be tough for people to deal with. So it'll be interesting to see how they treat it or if they kind of sensitize it a little bit.
Do you think LeVar Burton will be back in front of the camera or just stay behind it?
Probably behind the camera, I think, you know, kind of to maintain the authenticity of it, I think. I don't know if he'd be in front of the camera at this point.
Right, unless his character came back as a much older person or something,
exactly.
Something like that. Well, you have been at it as a researcher and as a speaker. You're an attorney as well forever and ever. Let's talk about some of your experiences, especially with Genealogy Roadshow. What has that done for your life?
It's changed it, obviously, in ways that I couldn't imagine. I mean, I am truly thankful and blessed that I'm able to do something I enjoy doing, and people like it. But it definitely, you know, living here in Santa Monica in the L.A. area, I didn't come out here to be on television. So to have that opportunity is really fantastic. And what I think we do is we change people's lives, and that's what I really enjoy about it. I enjoy that people come on the show, and they want to know about an ancestor, or they have a family story, and we're just able to kind of complete something for them and give them that closure. And that's very rewarding for me to be able to do that.
How do you wind up selecting your people for the show?
So there's a casting department with the production, and everyone submits their information, their story, and an application. And then they go through the process of selecting them and trying to see if they'll be good on TV. I mean, it's a little nerve-wracking being on television if you're not used to that, because there's so many moving parts, so many different people. So they try to look for people that will be able to kind of deal with that, and but also has a good story. Because at the end of the day, it is entertainment as much as it is about genealogy. So they want to make sure the story's good, the person's good, and they go through that process. We just really manage the research and the on-camera presentation.
Now, how did you wind up on the show, Kenyatta?
Well, actually, I was president of APG, Association for Professional Genealogists, and I received a call from the team at Genealogy Roadshow, and they were looking for a local genealogist. And I met with them to talk about that. And I kind of, you know, didn't have any idea what was going on, and I didn't realize I was meeting with the casting team at that time. And after hearing me talk about genealogy and how passionate I am about it, they wanted me to go home and do a Skype video, and so that's what I did. And I came home, I did the Skype, they sent it off to PBS, I talked to them about other stuff, and then the next thing I know, they were like, PBS loves you, and I'm on television. So it was not something I auditioned for.
Right.
It just kind of happened, you know?
Yeah, well, that's often the way it is in life, right? It's a hard left turn, hard right turn, you never know where you're going.
Exactly, exactly. So it's been great. It's been a very great experience.
That's awesome. How many years have you been doing it now?
So I've been doing professional genealogy about 17 years in the show. We're in our second season, and we're hopefully getting a third season. We should hear about that next month or so. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the business. You know, cancellations and renewals. It's always kind of a little bit scary that way, but you're obviously having a great time with it. What's been the best experience with the whole thing so far?
I think the best experience has been in season two, them kind of working out the kinks, you know, so to speak, and we still have a lot to do. But the best experience has just been I've had some really hard stories, but one of my favorites was a woman named Gail who came onto the show, and she, 15 years ago or so, had done research on her family, and she grew up as a white woman, and she went to do research on her mom, and her mom was listed as colored from New Orleans. So Gail just kind of like, her whole life changed at that moment. And she talked to her mom about it, and her mom denied, 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 and finally she's like, here's the proof. And her mother said, yes, this is true. I've been passing for white. However, you can't tell anyone while I'm alive. When I die, you can do whatever you want. And her mother passed on, and she came on the show. And she,
wow.
You know, she didn't know that her mom had four half-siblings. Like, she was able to find an entire different family, you know, or another part of her family. And for me, it was just so rewarding to see her, someone who kept that secret for so long, to bring it on the show, to be brave enough to do that, you know, on national television. I was really nervous about it, you know, because it's a big thing.
Sure.
It's life-changing. So that has been, just having that courage and that experience and sharing that with her just meant so much to me.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, we all have cultural identity. I mean, that's just part of the core of who we are. And and to actually have that changed, it has got to give you an entirely different perspective.
Mm-hmm. It did. And, you know, I think a lot of it was interesting because she was there with her family, her two kids, grandkids, and her husband. And as we just started to talk, what was really interesting is her husband would remember things about her mother. One of the things that he just said, he's like, your mother never liked to go out in the sun. And I said, you know why? She said, because she didn't want to tan. I mean, it was just those, it's just like all this stuff came back. The fact that they never went back to New Orleans to visit the family. It was just, you could just see the light bulbs going off, you know? And that's the one thing I just so love about the show is you never know what reaction you're going to get, but when you get something that's really good, you're just like, this is incredible.
Well, think back on it, though. I mean, what a different time and place New Orleans was for the mom as compared to the world that this daughter is growing up in now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For her to make that choice. And one of the things I thought was interesting is people often comment about that particular segment when they see me because they're just like, wow, for her to make that choice, for her to have to do that. And, you know, now for her daughter just to be coming out and sharing this with the world and saying, this is what happened, and now having this other piece of her family that she never knew. I mean, I think it's just really cool, and it kind of goes to why I think I love genealogy, and what's great about it is it's those connections, right? It's
your family
and history.
And the surprises, too. I mean, I would imagine, too, there's a lot of surprises among African Americans when they find out that they have European blood and how they have to deal with that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of surprises with that, but it's also sort of one of these things where you kind of heard about it and you knew about it, but when it's there, whether it's DNA or whether you find that ancestor, it kind of brings it to fruition. You know, it's like right there in your face.
Well, I'm thinking about African-American research. I mean, it's been a challenging thing for a lot of people for many, many years. I'm not one of those people who ever says genealogy is easy. I don't think that that's fair to most people who are interested in it or interested in getting started in it, because it's just really not the case. But it is easier now by far than it's ever been in the past. How has this affected African-American research?
So I think with African-American research, yes, access to records. Basic, you know, records, your vital records, your census records, is much easier than it has been in the past. I think with African-American research, being able to have access to the Freedmen's Bureau records has been good, because you can find information around whether it's the bank records or it's a labor contract, which was the case in my ancestors' background. You can now have those connections. And what's so important for us is that we need to be able to identify, if your ancestors were slaves, the slave-holding family, because those records lie with that family. So we get that bonus family, right? There's not only just our family, but there's the other family we're researching. And I think having access to those records online makes it easier, but you still have to go to the courthouses to get the wills, the estates, and all those things, and the probate records.
Right, which is the challenge that everybody faces. Because as much as is online right now, there's still so much more that's not, and that hopefully will be over the next 10 or 20 years.
Right. Yeah, I think we continue to see technology evolve and how we can leverage that technology for genealogy, not just having those newspapers and those records, but just figuring out how we can make it, I won't say easier, but more manageable, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, Kenyatta, let's take a break. And when we return, we're going to talk more about African-American research, the challenges that are faced there, more of what you were talking about, Kenyatta, about not only finding your ancestors' family, but often the slaveholders' family, and what that involves in connecting with descendants on both sides. That's got to be an interesting challenge for everybody.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll get to that when we return on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here talking to Kenyatta Berry. Of course, you know her from Genealogy Roadshow. She's a lecturer. She's an attorney. And we were talking about the challenges of African-American research. And you were telling me off air the other day, Kenyatta, that there's a real misunderstanding about records for African-Americans going way back.
Yeah, so I think one of the largest misconceptions we have is that 1870 was the first federal census that African Americans were enumerated that were former slaves. So if they were free before the Civil War, they were enumerated 1860, 1850. But a lot of people hit that 1870 brick wall, right? They get back to 1870 and they can't go beyond that. And then they think there are no records there, and that is not true. With slavery, slaves were property, so there are records related to slavery. But the challenge we have, as I talk about that bonus family, is we have to really understand or know the last slaveholding family or owner, because our relatives' records are tied to their records. So anything related to my family is going to be tied to the slaveholding family. And I think just getting to that point often frustrates African-Americans, and they often feel like, oh, I can't get there. But you can. And that's one of my goals, personally, is to let folks know that's available.
Right.
That record, that it's there. You know, you can do this research.
Well, and that's what this show is about, too, making sure people understand that there are misunderstandings out there that you have to get through. Don't make assumptions. And besides, even in areas where there are records that are difficult to obtain, maybe your record is available, and that's the point.
Right, absolutely. That you shouldn't give up and you shouldn't just kind of make a blanket statement or think it's not possible. I think a lot of times African-American research, we just run into that because dealing with or getting through slave ancestral research can be difficult, but it is part of our history. It's part of American history, and it's part of who we are. So I just really hope, and I hope people see that from the show, that we can just find these records and we can help people discover their ancestors.
Well, talk about that, Kenyatta. Have you gone through that experience of finding slave families in your lines? And then where do the records come from that you found?
Yeah, so I had two experiences. One was with my third great grandfather, Lewis Carter. I actually lived at the Freedmen's Bureau contracts in Virginia. So when I lived in the D.C. area, I lived about 50 miles away from Culpeper County, which is where my ancestors are from, Culpeper and Madison. And I was able to find a sharecropping agreement he had with a Dr. Taylor in Culpeper or in Madison. And that led me to other records related to during slavery, related to him and his family.
Now, the Dr. Taylor, was he a slaveholder previously?
He was, yes. He was the owner of my third great grandfather and
okay.
his family.
That just sounds so strange to you.
It does. It does. You know, but I think that's one of the things about being an attorney, and I talk about this often, and people who know lawyers understand it. One of the things that we're taught in law school is we are taught to remove emotion from a situation. And I think one of the ways that I'm able to do the research that I do is that I do it because I know it's important. And I know that if I can't get through it, I'm not helping someone, you know, uncover their ancestors or teaching them how to do so.
Right.
That's how I get through the research. And I think it's a really important research to do, you know.
Yes.
When doing African-American research, there's really two avenues you take in finding the slaveholding family. There is the sort of very common surname like Barry or Carter or the unusual surname because most slaves did not take the name of their last owner. They could have taken the name of a previous owner or a family member, or just picked one out of the blue because they didn't have surnames as slaves. So you can't necessarily say, oh, my ancestors were owned by the Berry family. But if there's an unusual surname, then more than likely it is related to the slaveholding family. And I had that happen on my paternal side with a family member, and I was actually able to connect with the white descendants of the slave owner. And they were able to verify that this second great-grandfather, his second or third, but his owner was actually his father. And the white descendant said that. They sent me a photo and like, oh, yeah, he looks just like him.
Wow.
Which never really happens. I mean, I think I had one of the better experiences.
It sounds like it.
Pretty interesting.
How was their reaction to you approaching them?
Oh, they were very open to it. They were very open to it. They were very excited about it. Like, they shared the photos, the family stories. They talked a lot about stuff. And, you know, we emailed back and forth for a couple months. So they were very, very open. I mean, it was probably one of the better reactions you could have to that situation, because I don't think everyone would get that reaction.
No, I would imagine not. It's kind of like approaching a birth parent, too, in an adoption situation, right? I mean, you just don't know where it's going to be. I've often told people that I've helped, look, you know, we've got numbers, we've got relatives' names here. You can call these people, but just remember, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. You got to be able to know that you might have to deal with rejection. And are you prepared to do that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I often tell people, you never know what you're going to find when you start digging through your family history, right? That's the thing.
Yes. Let me ask you, how many people in the African-American community now are researching? Are you finding it's comparable to the rest of the population at large?
I don't think it's comparable. I think there are a lot more people researching than when I started. I still think there is that misconception about not being able to find the records. And just also, people may not want to know. The one thing I do feel with African-American research, though, is DNA. One of the big things in the African-American community is always having this connection back to Africa. Everyone wants to get back to Africa, right? So with DNA, you're able to have that connection, so to speak. And I think people are kind of doing a lot. I think a lot of people are doing DNA, but not necessarily doing the research to back up the DNA, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right.
So they're just kind of rushing to judge and be like, okay, well, I got myself back to, you know, West Africa or wherever. And then all of a sudden, oh, okay, well, this is great. I've done my family history. I haven't done anything. But I do feel like that creates that bridge, right, to get us back there and to get people feeling like they're connected. And DNA has been very interesting. I mean, it's still evolving.
getting back to the emotional side of this, and you said you've been able to insulate yourself from it to some degree, basically because of your legal background and your legal training. When you've been working with clients and they discover some of these stories, have you actually had to help them work through some of the emotion of that discovery?
Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting because for me, I have to remember to not be so lawyerly, right?
Right.
Kind of have that emotional piece, right? Because I'm working with someone and they're not going to react the same way that I am reacting, or they're not living it every day, you know?
Right.
As much as I am constantly watching things about slavery or reading about slavery, people aren't doing this. And it's a very real emotion to see your ancestor listed as property. It is.
Yes, of course.
Just having to have them work through that and kind of just help them get through that process. And it can be challenging, but it's so important too.
You know, these records, they are time machines.
Mm-hmm,
and,
they are.
And the more we pour ourselves into them, you know, I time travel all the time and I find it fantastic. I love it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But there are times you find stuff that takes you back and it's not so fantastic. And it kind of sits with you for days, maybe even weeks.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think when I first started doing research, I remember seeing this probate record and, you know, seeing the mother or the child list this property. And it was, that emotion was so real for me. And I was like, wow, it was just very, very interesting because I thought, okay, this is something that I'm going to have to deal with in my family. And this is something that I'm going to have to help other people deal with. So, I think it's very important, but it's also something we need to do. And I think we can, if we address it, it may help us heal, so to speak.
That's right.
As a nation, I mean, because it's something that
we can't
sweep under the rug.
And, you know, really, 150 years ago was not that long ago. It's only like four or five generations. That's it.
That's it. I know. Sometimes it's kind of mind-boggling because you're like, wow.
Yeah, not that long.
Yeah.
Kenyatta Berry. She's from the Genealogy Roadshow. You can catch her on hopefully a third season coming up here soon.
Hopefully.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show and hope to have you back again sometime.
I would love it. Thank you so much for having me.
And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show on ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Hi, Tommy. How are you?
Super duper. Thank you.
All right. We're moving into warm weather. This means things when it comes to preservation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Some of the worst things you can do, whether you have vinyl, audio tapes, videotapes, photos, anything, is heat.
Oh, boy.
Leave them in an attic. Leave them in a garage. It's just really, really bad. This is, again, what we call preventative maintenance. Go over to grandma and grandpa's house. Go over to your parents' house and rummage through their attic. And anything that is like in an analog form, like photos, slides, negatives, VHS tapes, video tapes of any kind, audio cassettes, film, anything, get it out of the attic.
Right. Now, if it's in there and it's been there for years, you might already have a lot of problems, but it is salvageable, yes?
Generally. And the thing is, this could be the year that pushes it over the edge.
That's right. That's right.
We don't know that, so don't take the chance. We have people bring in 60-millimeter film to us quite often that has gotten so hot and cold temperatures it's been through that it's actually wavy. And sometimes it's kind of, I guess the best way to put it is shrunk in size.
Okay.
And so it can't go through a normal projector anymore because the holes don't line up. So what we can do is we have a belt machine that we can transfer it on. It's more expensive to do it that way because it's a lot more labor intensive. And sometimes it is so bad, you can't even do anything. In fact, the test I give them is called the vinegar test. Open up the top of the can, and if you smell vinegar, you need to get that thing transferred ASAP, or you might put it in a beautiful, cool area, but just sitting there in this state could make it just turn into dust.
Wow. All right. And most people do have something in their attic or in
absolutely.
A warm place. But there's also that concern about being in a closet with a wall that goes outside, especially if you're in an exceptionally hot place like in the Southwest or even in just the South in general.
Oh, yeah. External walls are really, really notorious for that. Another thing we talked about a few years ago is we had a customer that came in once and brought in a big stack. He had about 10 reels of film, and he brought them in. Hadn't even opened them. Just brought them in and said, hey, I want to get these things transferred. The first one we opened, it was dust. It had just totally turned to dust. The next one, it hadn't gone to dust, but it smelled real bad vinegary and was starting to break down. But as we got farther down, they were fine. And so we asked him, you know, where was this store? He said, oh, it was just in my closet. And I says, by any chance, is there a heating duct above your closet? And he goes, Well, yeah, but there's no vent in there. I go, well, the heat from the duct itself getting hot and cold and hot and cold because it's extreme. It's not like right. It's in the middle of the room where it's going to, you know, gradually get there. That's heat going through that duct. And so the top one basically took the brunt of it. And as it got down farther and farther, it was more insulated.
Isn't that interesting? So the top ones protected the bottom ones.
Exactly.
But took the bullet for them.
Right. Yeah, took the bullet for them. And if you have my kind of luck, the most important ones were the ones on top.
Yeah.
So you always want to be careful. There's not a duct going above or below. You know, sometimes they have heat returns and heat exhausts and stuff on the outside of your house. But the ducting is inside. And so if you have your stuff even down on the floor up against a wall, if there's a duct going down there that's an external, like a dryer vent or anything like that, you're going to ruin them.
You know, it's terrible that we really have to spend so much time talking about preservation in the context of fear.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's really what it's about. Is it in the right closet? Is it in the attic? Is it warm? Is it hot? Is it too cold? All these things kind of start to tally in your mind and you go, you know, it really is a matter of urgency. And you might be the only person in your generation who's ever going to do anything about this to salvage this material.
And usually when we get in our later years is when we really get interested in this kind of stuff. When we're young, sometimes we don't care, even though more younger and younger people are really getting into the preservation deal. But you got to be proactive. Don't just assume that everything's going to be fine. You want to check it out because it's not like you're scared of going over the speed limit because you're going to get a ticket. If you get a ticket, it costs you $100, $200. If you ruin your film and your photos and stuff, you may not get them back.
And Tom, let's just start with the assumption that you've got damaged goods now. What can people do to restore some of these things?
Okay, the best thing you want to do is go through all your stuff like we talked about several weeks ago, and you want to have a room where all your gunky stuff is, so to speak. Then when you work on it, you want to put that in a different spot. Then when you go and clean up a little bit more and get it ready for storage, you put it in a third spot so you don't get dust from what you got out of your closet and put it with stuff that you've taken some time to clean. So first thing what I would do is go through your film because that's usually the most volatile. Take your film, make sure you dust off all the cans and everything, then put them in another box. And then once you're done doing the dusting, then take that box into your second area. Then you want to go through your film and actually look inside the cans. If there's rubber bands that have been around them, get those out of those.
And those usually fall right off.
Oh, yeah.
Generally, they just break.
They do. And if you run into ones that have become so hot that they've actually melted onto the film, just leave them there. Let us work with that. Because sometimes we can take them off and still get your film. Sometimes it's shot. But you don't want to take that kind of a chance ripping them off yourself and damage them where we could have taken them off the proper way. Same thing with negatives. If you have negatives that have been rolled up for a long time, the chance of getting them to lay flat is almost impossible. And we see people that get out and string them up, put books on them and stuff, and then they crack.
Yes.
So we can't get them in how they're supposed to be. So
is there a way to take those that have curled to uncurl them? Is there a proper way?
Yeah, there is some
ways. Or is
ways.
That something you or your people have to
it's
do?
It's best to bring it into us. If you want to try doing it yourself, you can. Usually the best way to do is take the big rolls and make them smaller. What I usually do is I take them, whether they're film strips or whatever, and cut them into sections of about 6 frames. And those are the same kind you can put them in archive sleeves.
Huh.
If you go and cut them into those 6 pieces, it's going to be a lot easier to get those in an area where it's cooler and let them cool down and try and get them flat. You know, some people do the book ways, some people do other things, but that's something you want to have a little bit of humidity because it makes the Mylar come back so that it's a little bit softer, it's a little more flexible. I've even had people go so far as to put them in a water bath and then hang them up, which is okay.
Wow. And you're talking about lengths of film.
Oh, right. Lengths of film. Now, this is film like photographs, not 8mm and 16mm film. You don't want to be cutting that up.
Okay.
You want to bring that into us and let us do that. Otherwise, you're going to have all these 1-foot sections that are going to be,
yes,
you know.
That wouldn't work.
Yeah, very expensive. We can do it, but
yeah.
It's not the way to do it.
No, very labor intensive.
Yeah, this is more like 35mm film that you've taken in your Instamatic or something. In the old days, they came in 24 and 36 exposures, and you put them back in the cans, and they've sat there for 20, 30 years, and they've been hot, and now they're so tightly wound, you can't get them apart.
Right.
So if you cut those into like usually about 6 sections, so each picture you count 6 and cut those, then sometimes what you can do is put them in the sleeves and now make them come out flat just by letting them sit in there. If you have the big long reels, bring them into us or somebody that's a photo finisher, because then what we can do, we can get it wet again and we can hang it up and then put like the equivalent of clothespins on the bottom to kind of stretch it out. And if you do that, as soon as you get it wet, you've got to put it up, because if they're touching each other, you're going to damage your emulsion.
And so this is how you're able to make prints from these negatives, ultimately?
Right. Because if you've just taken these long things and put a big weight on them and cracked them, they're not going to sit in our system where we go in and scan them. Because we actually scan the film, whether we're doing film, movie film, or whether we're doing individual films, we scan them frame by frame, so you don't want to get them cracked. If you don't know what you have, bring it to us. Let us help you.
All right. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you.
That wraps up the show for this week. Thanks once again for joining us. Thanks to Kenyatta Berry from PBS's Genealogy Roadshow for sharing some of her insight into African-American research. Join us again next week. Take care. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.